Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Christy Ford-Chapin. She is the Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Christy, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for the benefit of the listeners, it would be great just to get a little bit of your history, background, how you arrived at this point before we dive in.
Okay, well, I am, as you stated at the beginning, a professor of history. So I have my doctorate in history. My specialty is modern political economy. And for my first book, which was based on my dissertation, I wanted to look at the political economy of the U.S. healthcare system. And what drove me to that topic was I was very interested in the role that insurance companies played in the healthcare system. There were some things about their role that didn't make a lot of sense economically. And so I was curious how, you know, what history told us about how that had developed. And the wonderful thing about being a historian is that we have to use primary sources. So we have to go back to the archives and what people were saying at the beginning of the century who helped construct the modern day healthcare system. And that was a very long but exciting and neat process, all the surprises that I found in the archives.
That's an interesting point. And I have to clarify it because, I'm not a typical guest in my sort of sequence, but I think highly relevant at this point, a historian. And when you say primary archives, help people understand what you mean by that.
So the historian, us in anthropology, we take the longest times to get our PhDs. And this is why, because we have to go to the primary sources. So somebody like me who's doing the United States, obviously I'm staying in the States. I don't have to go like some of my colleagues to Russia or one of my colleagues who goes to Iraq in the summers. So in that regard, I have it good. But I had to travel all around the United States to find the information from the people who actually created the healthcare system. So I went to archives related to the main health insurance trade association. Today it's known as AHIP. When I was studying, it was known as the Health Insurance Association of America, or HIA. So I found all their papers left by a leader to his alma mater. I also found a very huge store of papers from the AMA that had been overlooked that nobody had found before, from one of their most important post-World War II leaders. I was in Blue Cross and Blue Shield archives. Basically, I traveled all around the United States to find these papers and literally teared up a couple times over some of the findings. When I found the AMA papers, I definitely teared up a little bit because everybody wants to get in the AMA archives and they don't let scholars in. And I basically found just like 90 boxes of board of trustee meeting minutes and letters back and forth among the leaders, very inside baseball material down at the University of Texas Medical Branch. So that was just really exciting. And we're staying in really horrible hotels and eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on your graduate stipend.
Well, just to be clear, we've all done a little bit of that. So, right.
Yeah, exactly.
those awful hotels, I think we all have that little bit of history. I truly fascinated. I mean, I can picture that, you know, these archives and the opportunity to sort of open these boxes and dive in. I mean, I just think fascinating in terms of a potential discovery. And clearly, you know, that led you down not just for your thesis, but ultimately for a book. Tell us a little bit about the book and what it's about.
Well, what it's about, some of the surprises, as we were discussing right before we started this conversation, was I was surprised to find that I went in knowing, of course, that the AMA was very much against government intervention in healthcare. What I was surprised to find is how much against the market and market competition and anything to do with free enterprise or competitive markets they were. That was very important to understand in order to understand the system we have today. A lot of people assume that the AMA wanted market competition and they didn't. The healthcare system we have today, believe it or not, is based on a model that AMA leaders made up in 1938. And it was such an odd model that there was no precedence for it in the marketplace. At that time in the 1920s, 30s, there were all kinds of very interesting models for financing and delivering healthcare in the United States. You had mutual aid organizations that would contract with physicians. You have unions that would do similar. They would contract with physicians. Some of them would even set up their own healthcare locations where they would actually manage the physicians and patients and such. Corporations had all manner of way that they would provide health care. So there were a lot of really neat experiments going on. One of the neatest models that I found was what were called prepaid physician groups. This is what physicians seem to want to do, is to get together in these multi-specialty groups. So they're kind of, they were like one-stop shopping for the patient. And the patient, instead of paying an insurance company as we do today, would instead pay their monthly fee directly to the group. So the group financed itself, behaved as an insurer, and also provided the care. And this was really important for a couple of reasons. And one of them was that because of the way the funding mechanism was set up, is it kept costs in control, because physicians would not be rewarded for overutilization. Today, we know under fee-for-service payment that physicians that provide more procedures, more services, they can get that bill that's going off to an insurance company up higher. But with these prepaid doctor groups, there was no reason for overutilization. But of course, we know that the other side, the other problem on the other side, is systems where rationing is a problem. But you also didn't see that under prepaid groups, because if the patient felt like they weren't getting really high quality care or something was being withheld from them, then that was very bad advertisement. You would lose customers. You could potentially lose future customers. So these prepaid physician groups were very interesting for the way they forced the physician, who is the person with that requisite expertise, to kind of walk that very difficult line between overutilization and rationing. It's a very tricky line to walk. And so these prepaid physician groups, they were fantastic for keeping the costs in line for this reason, but they also provided integrated care, which is something that we are sorely lacking today in the United States. And anybody who is chronically ill or has a number of diagnoses knows it's very difficult to keep control of your healthcare. And there is no one person managing it, though theoretically your general practitioner is, they do not have the time to do so. So
all of this, constantly ringing in my head is, any fool can learn from experience. The trick is to learn from other people's experiences. I don't know. I feel like we failed to do so. We had all of these experiments. You saw the full, I don't know that the full spectrum, but you saw a broad spectrum. As you looked at this, was there anything, obviously the direct care group stood out. Any other models at the extremes of good and bad that were showing up as poor examples and good examples?
Well, it's hard to say. If you look at the 20s and 30s, the market was really, it was laissez-faire pretty much in healthcare, except for the fact licensing, which actually was more important marketplace intervention than you would think. A lot of people think licensing is very minor. What I found in healthcare is licensing actually ended up giving the AMA the ability to be the primary regulator of the healthcare market, because they controlled all the licensing boards in each state. They don't have that kind of power today, but at the time they had the power to pretty much pull any physician's license that they did not like the way they were behaving. And one thing they would not like is to see physicians participating in union groups, contracting with mutual aid societies. A lot of these mutual aid societies, by the way, they were very important in the United States for immigrant groups and African Americans. This is the way they got their welfare before we had a welfare state. Very important for life insurance and health insurance. So to your question about good examples and bad examples, because it was an open and competitive market, you don't really have a lot of bad examples, because the marketplace either would or would not support them. And that actually is what makes the model that the AMA invented in 1938 so interesting. In one way, we know it's going to be a bad model, is that it didn't exist in the marketplace. They had to force it on everyone. So that's an indication right there that something is not going correctly with economic efficiency and transaction costs. And in brief, if we want to talk about bad models, this is the model that we are, our system currently is designed around. The model that the AMA came up with is they decided they were going to go ahead and approve insurance up until 1938, believe it or not, kicking and they fought insurance, voluntary, free market insurance with everything they had. Finally, under federal pressure, when it looks like the government's going to intervene, they compromise and say, okay, we'll accept insurance. But they would only accept insurance through insurance companies. And that was really important, that it couldn't come through a union, a prepaid physician group, a mutual aid society. It had to be these corporate insurance companies. And one reason the AMA wanted that is because they were far away from physicians, you know, generally located in one city, not like a union or mutual aid society that's very close to the physician and can monitor the physician. So they wanted to do this for autonomy. Another important part of their model was that it would be fee-for-service payment, which a lot of your audience is probably familiar with, meant that the physician would receive a payment for every single service and procedure, no capitation, no salaries, of course, and that the physician was to have complete autonomy over the way he, at the time, it would have been he, not she, but he practiced medicine. That is the way it started off. It was, for physicians, it was great for the first couple of decades, but as you can imagine, that created such cost problems, which everybody knew it was going to create cost problems. Physicians knew, Republicans knew, Democrats knew, insurers knew. Insurers didn't even want to get involved. They looked at what the AMA was doing and really were not happy about getting pulled into the model at all. But they felt like they had to go along with them for political reasons to keep the government out of healthcare. This idea that they're taking one for the entire business community by keeping healthcare from falling, so to speak, to government intervention. So then over time, of course, as costs get out of hand, that's where we start to see the insurance companies little by little, very incrementally starting to put in cost controls. So that over the course of decades, we get to the point where it flips and the power goes from residing primarily with the physician who has the power and the autonomy and also decides how medicine is practiced, till it goes to the power now resides with the insurance company who, through cost controls, decides how medicine and reimbursements and treatment blueprints and any number of regulations that it puts on physicians now is in charge of dictating how medicine is practiced and certainly and the amount that physicians earn and such.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dr. Christy Ford Chapin. She is an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We were just talking about the history and, you know, quite frankly, fascinating to hear actually a different perspective and one certainly from my understanding, different to how I understood the way that things came about. And the AMA, sort of central to this, coming up with a model that was untested in the marketplace, which, you know, you have to question immediately. And we have this model and this sort of slow shift. The obvious question in my mind now is, given you've got this deep understanding and history, and that informs how we got here, you can't ignore history, at least not in my experience. How do we start to fix this? What is our pathway out of what is essentially a system that's working as designed?
Right. Well, and this is the difficulty because so much of our regulation that is built up at both the state and federal level has been around this model and attempting to come in and put band-aids on this very bad, bad model. And as different regulations come in, it deepens that path dependency of that model, that there aren't a lot of ways that the market can go because it keeps getting hemmed in further and further. The first thing being that the AMA said, this is the only model we're going to allow, and we're going to go and take away any physician's license that does not go along with our plan. So the path out of it, I'm not entirely sure because as I was saying, it is a bit difficult. If anything, it requires rolling back, I think, some federal and state regulations to allow physicians to return to what it is they wanted to do before. I think it's very interesting that their instinct was to form these multi-specialty groups where they act as the insurer. Now, today, the way that would have developed, you know, in a counterfactual world, isn't that physicians would pay I think what would happen is physicians in these groups would have ended up purchasing reinsurance, right? So once a patient hits a quarter of a million, half a million, or whatever it may be, then insurance kicks in. But the insurer's far enough removed that they're not actually in the exam room with the physician deciding how the patient should be treated. And we know that a lot of cost problems come from that, not just because of fee-for-service billing, but that physicians even feel like they can't do certain treatments or treat things a certain way because they have to follow a certain blueprint in order to get reimbursed. So my hope is that we do find a way forward that puts more on, that gives physicians more autonomy and lets them have more, you know, decision-making power with the patient, and to also even imagine their practices the way they want them without having to worry so much about what's allowed and not. I think if we went back to something like the prepaid physician group, today there's the direct, the DPC, the direct primary care, is physicians attempting to replicate these prepaid physician groups, except for they're only doing it for general practice right now. They're not multi-specialty because of the hurdle of having to get over trying to figure out hospital admissions and admitting privileges there. So I think that is something that's really exciting to consider, because we could see how physician groups might specialize in general practice or come up with all kinds of creative ways to keep their patients healthy in order to earn more money, whether it's, you know, hiring a nutritionist or, you know, sending a van around to go pick up elderly patients or any number of things we can think of. The marketplace is always so creative with coming up with these wonderful ideas, but a lot of that has stopped in the United States because we are so hemmed in by this one model, and then how all the regulations have tied everybody to this model, even though we all know it doesn't work.
So it sounds like, you know, the steps are to start to unravel some of that narrowing that's taken place with regulations. You know, revolutionary thought, remove some of the regulations. There's a piece of this that's interesting. I want to hear what you think about this. So I think one of the things that seems to have occurred with all of this, you know, imposition of regulations and mandates and so forth, is that there's been misbehavior, and bad behavior has induced regulation to try and prevent others. But that tends to be, in my experience, a very narrow band. But what we've done is legislated everybody to satisfy. And here you are saying, trust the physicians. They want to do the right thing. And I think that's the right way to approach. How do we deal with the sort of the negative, the potential negatives out of that, do you think?
Well, and I'll actually give you a great example to illustrate exactly what you're saying. So, for example, in the 1970s, a lot of states passed law saying physicians couldn't own their own diagnostic centers, right? In most states, this is the case. And that made sense because under fee-for-service payments, the physician was incentivized to across the street have a lab and send every single patient that comes through, right? These are the unethical physicians, the ones that stand out. Most physicians are not this way, but the system very much encouraged them to do this. And plus, you can see how anybody in that situation would rationalize to themselves, well, I'm just giving them gold standard treatment.
Right.
So please understand the physicians are not behaving in any differently than any other group would. So that is outlawed. And now today, these direct primary care practices, they are now going back and trying to roll back all the state regulation that keeps them from being able to expand what they can do. Because where they've been able to get regulations like that rolled back, then they also, since they're general practitioners, they also offer often labs and diagnostic tests. And they've been very, very good at also working with pharmaceutical companies to get prescription costs way down. And again, that's because they have to get over this regulation and hurdle of being able to even provide prescription medicines for their patients, something that, again, these DPC groups actually have to go to the state capitol and lobby to get regulations rolled back in order to even have the space in the market to open up these practices, which once they are opened, they're seeing they're very popular. And people like them a lot. But I'm not just trying to say I just endorse DPCs, direct primary care. I'm just saying that is one lane mm-hmm. that shows us one place where physicians have been able to have more control over what they're doing.
It reminds me a lot of the medicine that I certainly remember practicing many years ago, and highly attractive. It's much more engaged with the community, trying to find the healthy pathway. You get what you incent, ultimately. We've got a little bit of time left. I want to get to one of the points that I've heard you talk about, which is, you know, the public health officer or that resource in businesses and the need for that, especially given, you know, COVID-19 has sort of focused the attention. How should businesses be thinking about this? Right now, we just, you know, you contract, get insurance, and that's it. But I think it's much more than that now.
Well, actually, there's a long history behind these public health officers or these health officers that we're seeing now in corporations. If you go back to the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, there were a lot of, you know, this is the period of muckraking journalism, right? And there were a lot of exposés about how horrible factory conditions were for workers. So, and I think this is, we're going to see a similar incentives working today with COVID, is that corporations are going to have a PR problem. If it gets out, for example, you'll hear sometimes that, you know, Amazon had a warehouse where a lot of people got sick. And this is a PR problem for them because they don't want the story out there that they're bad to their laborers, they're bad to their workers. That's going to increase political pressure on them always. That's going to always increase the likelihood that they'll have more regulation, more government intervention in their business. So even thinking about things like corporate social responsibility in this country, you see there's a long history of corporate social responsibility to fend off government getting involved. This idea of the business leader saying, hey, policymakers and politicians, we have this under control. So in the case I was talking about at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, that's when you first saw what was called industrial medicine, where these factories would hire physicians to be on their staff, to be like a middle manager, basically, to go around and look at the, well, of course, it was also very useful for weeding out potentially sick employees, but also to make sure that the conditions were good in the factory. And I think it's a very similar thing you see playing out today. Corporations can protect themselves by saying, we have somebody here in charge who's, you know, keeping up with all the latest, because as we know, the information about COVID changes all the time, week to week, what we know about it, to have somebody in charge of keeping up with what's going on and then implementing the appropriate policies so that, you know, in case there is a lawsuit or complaints to policymakers, they have the ability to say, this is when we had this information and these are the steps we took.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I, to be clear, I don't think this is a short-term thing. It's something that, you know, moving forward, it's funny, I hadn't thought about it, but, you know, we must have had it in the past. So in the closing minute or so, any thoughts about how to go about that and how organizations can capitalize on this, you know, capability and resource and start incorporate? Because that sounds expensive.
It's really going to depend on the corporation and the size and what type of business it is in, right? In order to make that cost benefit analysis. I do think a lot of corporations are going to come in thinking about how they can protect themselves. But I think the way you ask the question actually sheds a lot of light on it, and the idea that you might be thinking of this as the way to protect yourself from lawsuits or adverse regulation, but this is actually an opportunity for you to think about ways for your workers to have a healthier workplace, a happier workplace, more work-life balance. And these are conversations that they can have and take this potentially negative situation and turn it around into a positive.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time. I'm just truly fascinated. I'm very excited about this episode. It's been a little while in the making, but, you know, in terms of history, it informs so much of what we can understand and learn and then apply going forward. It just remains for me to thank you for joining me on the show today. It's been a tremendous conversation. Christy, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com, and tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.